Good afternoon. It's 5 o'clock on Tuesday, March the 1st here in London, and in Amsterdam that makes it 6 o'clock European time.
It does.
My guest this week is the peripatetic Sharon O'Day, who we are meeting for the first time, but have been, as often happens, circling each other on Twitter. Love following her Twitter feed, although somewhat jealous when she was in Mexico and then Thailand before that lately. So the way I put it is I like the phrase WFA. When everybody started talking about, what's it mean not being in the office? You're kind of going, I've been like doing this for 20 years. So I call it working from anywhere. So I think you kind of work from anywhere. But I love your Twitter feed and whatever you talk about. So I know you have a professional life. You don't tend to talk about that. and really just here to hear what's on your mind and what's now and what's next. So perhaps just say a little bit about yourself and then whatever is on your mind.
Okay, no pressure. So my name's Sharon O'Day. I always hate this "what do you actually do" kind of question, but I guess the simple answer is I'm a digital strategist. So I really specialise in digital workplace collaboration and the future of work. So I tend to work with larger, more complex organisations to help them understand the right mix of technology, but also processes, culture, governance and so on that they need to communicate and collaborate effectively with their employees and sometimes also with their customers.
How long have you been focused on that?
It was one of those sort of fell into it things, but I guess I've been in the internal comms space and in digital communications since about 2006.
Mm-hmm.
I started out in publishing. I'm a communicator by profession. Mm-hmm. So I started out in journalism at The Guardian, in fact, and then on a newspaper that no one read in Bolivia. And from there, I moved into communications for a whole load of government organizations and then into banking. But I'm really I'm a lifelong nerd. So I've been tinkering with websites and with early incarnations of social media since the 90s, really. So it just so happened to be that being a communicator, as all of this kind of social media and social communication thing was on the rise, kind of somehow turned into an actual job and a career. And I've been doing that ever since, really.
And that's an interesting transition from communications, internal comms, into digital workplace and everything that goes with that, and a digital strategist. Interesting is one of those banned words in communication. So, intriguing. I approach it from a different angle. I was running businesses for many years. And then I kind of got obsessed with the fact that you couldn't measure culture. Because I'm a recovering accountant, so I'm fluent in finance. I'm passable in English. No Dutch at all. So I just got obsessed with that. That's kind of my backstory. But my paid gig is working with business leaders on, and really what I work with them on is not anything to do with their business. It's all to do with culture, communications, and leadership's all about people, right? So it's all about communication. So I approach it in perhaps a different angle. And I will say that after the first couple of months of just being locked down and nobody doing anything much at all, once the pandemic started, I was run off my feet with people just talking to me about what does the workplace look like now? Mm-hmm. I said, well, the first thing is you need to communicate with people. Well, what do I say? I said, well, you know, and there's interesting conversations around that. So obviously the digital workplace, the whatever all that looks like it's been a big part of my work for the last couple of years, but just approaching it from a different direction.
Absolutely. So, I mean, these days I do less. Well, I can't even remember the last time I actually produced some communication, but that it's actually trying to understand what is stopping that communication from happening. So often we'll have an organization will come along and say they've either got a technology, but it's just not working. So you might have Teams or whatever it might be, but, you know, the engagement just isn't there. Or they have an old platform that is maybe a burning platform, they need to replace it. But often there's an over-focus on that technology, mm-hmm. when actually the real reasons why communication isn't happening are much more likely to be to do with the culture, leadership, mm-hmm. some of the processes they have around that. Often there are big governance challenges. And the thing that I often find is is a lack of understanding of user needs. So it's kind of combining my knowledge of communications and being a communicator by background myself with actually the sort of digital product manager side, which is, what does that look like? Who is our customer? What is the user need? And how do we design our communication products, channels, processes so that so they're more effective? So it tends to be that we end up on focusing on programs that are potentially unblocking what you already have rather than necessarily recommending a new technology.
So it's the people and communication side of it somewhat.
Absolutely.
So if you had a large corporation come to you and say, we've heard you do this kind of thing. We've got the tech, but it doesn't seem to be working. Or this people aren't using it. Where would you start?
This is pretty much all my work at the moment. So, you know, 2 years ago, almost exactly 2 years ago now, you know, the pandemic came along and people were sent home with their laptops and they probably had Teams, but they weren't really using it. And the reality is people have kind of muddled together, you know, some sort of facsimile of whatever they might have been doing in the office previously. So they're doing a lot of video calls. They're not actually, they've got actually the right tools in place, you know, inside their organization. They simply don't have either the culture or the skills or the knowledge to be able to use those to work more effectively, because we've now got the opportunity to have this step change in how we work. You know, we've broken the connection between work and place and potentially also between work and time so that we can work in ways that are much more distributed. But to really take advantage of that, we don't simply just have to spend our entire day on Teams calls or Zoom calls. We actually need to rethink how work gets done. And that is often quite countercultural. It requires us to take a different approach to management, to supervision, to performance, to so many other aspects of how we get things done at work. Which is a huge change, which is where I end up in the sort of future of workspace. I'm always thinking about what's next.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, that's a great piece of language I heard you use, that we've broken the connection between work and place and to some extent between work and time. And if you go back into really old technology, I used to live in the Cayman Islands for many, it's my home, but I live in London now, for 27 years.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early 90s, because we were in, internet really started like 94, 95, email that is. The biggest law firm in Cayman had lights burning brightly in part of the building 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
Because they'd opened offices in Hong Kong and London. That was the fax room in the days before email.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the big documents were sent by FedEx on memory sticks or whatever back then. But that was breaking a connection between work time.
Absolutely. And I, you know.
Work, so that's also fascinating. And distributed teams, you know, the advantage of doing that.
Which is, I find this really fascinating, because before I started my own consultancy practice, I worked for a big global bank for years. Mm. And actually, although they do work in those really distributed ways that we kind of, the rest of us have got used to ever since, which is, you know, we've got colleagues on the other side of the world that, or even down the road, that potentially we haven't spoken to or met. So people are able to collaborate and communicate across distance, but somehow we haven't quite or hadn't quite broken that time aspect, that people would do their 9 to 5 and we would always find sort of awkward meeting slot at 8 o'clock in the morning or 7 or 6, or, you know, if it was really urgent, then even earlier or later in the day for someone, when actually we need to rethink that much more fundamentally so that we're not relying on one another to be online at the same time. And once we do that, we are actually able then to become much more distributed geographically, but also to tap into talent markets across the world and work potentially much more effectively and efficiently.
It's, I mean, we're diving into this because we both obviously do a lot around this and are interested in it. Yes, I mean, I have quite a number of young adults around me. So, and they're of an age where they're very identity conscious, so you don't talk about who they are and what they're about. One of them, we're talking sort of early to mid-20s, and, you know, one's based in the UK and works for a global bank.
Mm-hmm.
I said, so you're going to go back into the office, how many days a week do you need? He says, well, I mean, our team is on 3 continents already. So it's like, we really figured 1 to 2 days a week, but any more than that doesn't really work for the team, you know. Another one is based in Cayman,
mm-hmm.
and manages a team, half of whom are in India.
Yeah.
She's literally the other side of the world on time zones. So they have the advantage of effectively almost a 24/7 team. But the disadvantage of the fact that they need to be on calls at weird times of day to just for check-ins, just to be the manager to check in with them, how's things going, what do you need? And a little odd one, I look to sort of model certain behaviors, and going back to when you all were in the same time zone, I'm old enough to remember before email, and I even used to, you know, hand write documents as an accountancy apprentice and send them to the typing pool. But the Cayman Islands is all about communication globally. It always has been.
Mm-hmm.
When BlackBerrys came out in like 03, 04, and also you could have these new emails, which you'd only had for a couple of years, all of a sudden they're in your hands. And then that became, instead of being this, you might remember the theory from Keynes in the 30s, that we'd all be people of leisure and we'd only work 3 or 4 hours a day. Whereas in fact, what actually happened and still happens is that we're connected all the time, except the disease now is called Slack, or Teams chat or whatever. So we set up we had a business running that was working all over the place. And we just said, look, for the team itself, you may communicate at any time, but the core hours for each office, any emails received after the core hours, there has to be no expectation of them being replied to until core hours the next day.
Right? And global organizations have been doing this for years. You know, when we talk, we need to get people back to the office, they can collaborate. Actually, big banks, multinational corporations have been grappling with these challenges for a decade, if not more. I mean, the first program I did when I worked at Standard was exactly that. It was creating more location-independent working, actually at the time, so that we didn't have people commuting in for the London Olympics when there might have been a more squeeze on the teeth. Organisations have been grappling with some of this. And it's actually the difference, I think, that's happened over the last couple of years has been previously co-located organisations are now grappling with the same challenges, and maybe they haven't had the opportunity to work those through. So one of the quite alarming stats I read recently was productivity for knowledge workers did not fall during COVID, but people worked more hours. So their productivity per hour dropped because things that used to be relatively simple, you know, you used to be able to lean across the desk and go, Dave, do you know where that file is? Or could you show me how this thing works? Suddenly becomes complicated.
Yeah.
Suddenly we're much more reliant on our digital tools to do quite basic stuff, you know, to book things, to access help, to find the information that we need. But what people have found is that they're then trying to compensate for their lack of productivity by working longer rather than smarter. And that's having all manner of impacts on well-being in particular, but also, you know, some of that work-life balance stuff. And this whole conversation around, you know, we're not just kind of working from home, but living at work to some degree. And people who are grappling with what we used to have, you know, my other half would complain constantly that I was always on my work phone and getting emails at every hour of the day or night. Actually, how do we start to set appropriate boundaries so that we get that balance of responsiveness and also the need to really respect people's work-life balance? These are challenges that people are now working through, and to kind of go back a full circle here, when we talk about, you know, what's next for a lot of organizations, it's kind of unpicking the bad habits of the last 2 years. It's about, you know, we went home, we got through that crisis period, but everyone's over it now. We want to take what we learned during that period. And some of it was great in terms of, you know, helping people to assess the way that they get work done, to work more effectively, to stop doing some of the bad practices we used to have, to really accelerate bringing in the technology programs and platforms that we need to get work done. But actually a lot of it is we need to relearn our management behaviors, our collaboration, because collaboration is a skill by itself. We need to learn. It requires much more overt, explicit communication with our colleagues that potentially we're just not used to it, particularly for those of us who've maybe got our backgrounds in regulated industry. You're used to not constantly narrating what you're doing because there is an expectation you keep things close to your chest. And we're having to sort of relearn, and particularly for those of us who are a little bit older who come, you know, maybe to relearn how to manage and relearn how to communicate so that we're able to do that in those ways that are distributed across place and time.
Centering on the, rather than the detail, centering on the core theme of breaking the connection between work and place and work and time, and the piece you were talking about is you might be looking at technology, but actually fundamentally a lot of the organizations, certainly larger ones, will already have the technology.
Yep.
But they're kind of going, yeah, it's not really kind of working for what we need now. If people are location independent, et cetera. And it's going back to first principles. I think it's fascinating. It's one of the lazinesses of being the language of co-located is good, like one office in London, Amsterdam, mm-hmm. wherever. The people are so used to behaving in a certain way. And like so many people, I did, and I'm sure you did, we're like countless events on Zoom or Teams in the first year of the pandemic. And now somebody says, do you want to come on something at 7 o'clock in the evening? And really, the answer is generally no. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the first few months, it was yes, I'm, you know, locked in the house, whatever. But now it comes about what type of thing is it going to be? And mm-hmm. you'll have things like webinars that are put on, which has no interaction with the audience. And I'm going, okay, just send me the recording. I don't need to be there. But there are all kinds of experimental ones. And at some point, one of the loose networks I was in, put on one and said, we're going to try this app. And somebody cannot stand networking events. Mm-hmm. I'm the one who stands in the corner and talks to somebody I know. Right? It's just, you know, I'm pretty conversational, but I'm not an extrovert in a loud space. And somebody came up with an app that effectively mimicked a stand-up networking event.
Did it work? Did you feel like you were actually?
It was really weird because you had to have the same dynamics. So people would form groups, and you could see them, and you could walk over to them, and you could join you could listen in on the conversation if you were close enough, and you could join the conversation if mm-hmm. you stepped in another step, and you just use your mouse or trackpad or whatever. And it did kind of work, but mm-hmm. it reminds me of, we once did some training for a professional services firm offshore for a big event, and they were very, very socially awkward. Let's put it this way, even like me or worse. And luckily we had somebody who was drama trained.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, okay, well, what do you do if there's two people standing having a conversation over, you know, a drinks event or something, and how do you join the conversation? And they taught them how to do that in a physical way as an actor would go to their mark or something. And I thought, my God, you need to teach that for this. And what really struck me about this particular app, whether or not it's taken off, was it was designed completely to replicate something that was dependent upon location, that was dependent upon pseudo-random interactions, that was dependent upon doing something. It was a replication online of what's happened. Now, there's somebody that I talked to early in the pandemic who was like almost a goddess to facilitators, right? Mm-hmm. Because she had every tool for doing it digitally. So even before the pandemic, lots of facilitators were doing things in, you know, multi-jurisdiction. How do you do it? And how do you do it so you're not just on a whiteboard or whatever?
Yeah.
And the biggest frustration, and then much of their work is with universities, and of course they were run off their feet. And of course they were simply trying to replicate the old ways of doing things. So yeah. I think when you take the disconnect work and place and work and time, you go, what, we have these people, these knowledge workers, and we have solutions we're looking for them to create for us. What are we looking to get, and therefore what's getting in our way? And as you're saying, it's not likely to be the technology. It's likely to be the way people manage hierarchically, how they do things up, down, and sideways. And I guess if you're looking at first principles, if you were to come into an organization, or if you were giving advice now to somebody who's listening who runs a business, mm-hmm. they go, well, we've probably got Teams and Zoom, and found a way to model through this, but how can we really take advantage of this? Where would you start?
I always start with discovery, which is, you know, actually spend some time understanding what are the real barriers to it working successfully at the moment. So I have a little model I describe as my Miss Marple model, which is when you're trying to identify in any sort of crime drama who did the murder, you're actually looking for three things, which are the means, motive, and opportunity. And what we often find is people have the means, that is to say they might have teams or similar collaboration technology. The things that are missing are either opportunity, which is, do they have time in their day and the right kind of, so, you know, when you have people in, say, frontline roles or whose time is otherwise managed, then the opportunity is often the issue. But the other one is the motivation. Actually, is it that there's fundamentally nothing there worth reading? or are they otherwise disengaged and simply don't care enough about your organisation to spend their time, you know, engaging in that sort of way. So actually there is that over focus on means and then under focus on the other two elements that I often find. So often when I talk to organizations, I will say, let's spend some time actually understanding what I find really valuable is I go into organization and spend some time understanding the myriad ways in which they go out of their way to not use the channels that you provide. So they'll have hugely convoluted routes to finding things on sort of shared drives, the amount of stuff that people have printed on their desks or you know, all the other routes that they will use to access information. It's fascinating to do that kind of workplace anthropology. So that's broadly where I would start. But anyone can do that with really pretty basic research skills, which is to really get into the detail of what is it about your existing communications channels, processes that are simply just not working. And start from that. You know, what ultimately what can you mean?
Oh, sorry. I'm
yeah, yeah, carry on.
You dive too much. So Miss Marple, means, motive, opportunity. They've typically got the means. There may be time or other constraints. They may not have the opportunity. It's interesting you then got into the motivation, and that's, I'm assuming, I'm looking at this as almost a layperson. So I know enough to be dangerous, but not that much more. So there's a degree of desk research. You could go and look at it or have somebody look at it and go, well, what are people doing with shared resources? Are they using them? Are they downloading them, et cetera? But then I guess there's also cross-sectional interviewing in an organization.
Yeah, I would say I often do a little bit of going into organizations and we'll do interviews either, well, or usually both with both, you know, some of your leadership team, people in sort of key management roles to understand what is it about their area that is potentially a challenge. And yeah, end user interviews to say, you know, how do you look for specific things? Where do you go for information? It's sort of identifying, you know, some of the informal networks that people use or otherwise their informal channels. It's basic user research like you might do for an external product as well to understand what are the barriers to successful engagement.
And I think one of the tendencies in old school leadership is to be hierarchical and to go, well, you have to do it. This is the way we're doing it. You have to use it. And there is a place for rules and strictures, etc. But it's a very Caribbean phrase. It's a lot easier to pull than to push a rope.
Yeah.
So if people are motivated, and so hopefully they know what they're there to do and what the success looked like and what has been productive looked like. But if they're not doing it, and if they're not collaborating and being connected and other people and resources,
we also need to remember collaboration isn't an end in itself. You know, if we're talking about an outcome, people collaborate in order to get their work done.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, you know, another phrase I massively overuse is utility is the number one driver of adoption. So we need to find the things people actually need to do.
Right.
And then you might need to put your communications in the way of them doing that so they happen to see it, you know, as part of that journey. Or you identify what it is that they're actually, what do they actually need? And is it simply that what we're giving them is unnecessary or wrong?
It's, I've always got a vision of like a paid Google ad in the middle of an intranet, right, towards those common channels. And like, you just see a thing that says, oh, by the way, sign up for a random coffee.
It's not even that. It's actually ultimately people. So when the intranet is a great example, no one goes to the intranet to read their workplace news. Simply no one cares about what your CEO is doing that much. What they do is they're opening their browser to look at the weather, to find out something else they might need to do, you know, whatever it is, and that you need to put what you're doing in their face on the way to doing the thing that they are actually intending to do, which is how all sorts of other kind of marketing messaging works. So it is simply about precisely what is it that people are trying to do? Is it they're trying to get a job done? And we can also think about, you know, actually, is it helping them to do that thing? And if it isn't, then what's it for?
Well, I think of an example. One of the things that people have looked to do to create elements of serendipity is to have things like random coffees.
Yeah.
An organization. But they might not be motivated to do that. But if you had your own intranet on your web browser and you go in there and you're going to look at the things you look at in the morning on your dashboard or whatever, and you see something there goes like, you know, and it becomes stories, because I'm a huge one for storytelling. So it's about stories of successes for how people met and did something. And you go, oh, you know, and you say like, 30 seconds and you could watch a video or something. So it's a marketing strategy that's internal, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that's quite an interesting point, sort of slightly tangential around actually one of the other So when we look at data of how people have worked has changed just over the course of the pandemic, one thing we've found is that people are generally, a lot of data seems to show people are working longer, but the other thing that seems to have happened is people's social circles have collapsed.
Yes.
So we've become much closer to the people that we work with really regularly, but our actual ability to tap into broader networks, the industry, or even within our own organization seems to have got worse because we're just building off established trust and people that we maybe only used to see a couple of times a year or would just check in with less frequently. They've fallen off our radar a bit. So one of the challenges we do have over the next year is how do we reestablish that? Microsoft call it inner and outer loop. How do we help people to tap into that outer loop in their own organization? Because that is where the magic happens, really. That's where things like innovation come from. That's also what makes us get excited about coming to work. It's not simply about the five or six people we work with every day, but what makes us, you know, excited about what comes next or excited about the organization we work for is really having that much broader understanding of the ecosystem and where we're going. So there is a need to think a bit more creatively about how do we help people to tap into the broader whole.
And if we link to that, this is actually about getting work done and having results. And
yeah.
Because the vast majority of people aren't running their own business. Like, you know, they're in a job. They need career progression. They need monitoring and they need to, you know, have their performance assessed and how they're doing and all that kind of stuff. So what will motivate them is things that help them do their job and progress. And the late Tony Hsieh, who created an amazing culture at Zappos, built the Zappos headquarters in Las Vegas. And he designed, it was all co-located. There were 1,000+ people, often call center staff. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, most online businesses have huge call centers. They had to funnel through a narrow hallway and every single member of staff from the top to the bottom, because it was a hierarchy at some level, had to do that. And they literally bumped into each other. And because he believed in what he called ROCs, ROCs, and the RO stood for return on.
Oh, yeah.
So ROC, return on culture, our return on community. And one of them is called return on collisions.
Okay.
And so I'm somebody who, much like Tony Hsieh, does not believe in coincidence. I believe in creating space for serendipity. I also believe there are Zemplanity people out there, which is the opposite of people who have serendipity. So they're people to whom bad things always happen. But good things happen by creating space for it. So if we were to say, so what happened was that nobody objected to the collisions, the literally bumping into people in Zappos, because it created space for serendipities. And they were then encouraged to go, and if you bump into somebody, have a conversation with them if you're waiting for the lift or whatever. So, and this was ultimately, much like the much vaunted Google 20% time and stuff, was actually designed to see where the magic happens. Mm-hmm. So if we linked, and that's just a story example, but if businesses linked that there's a benefit to the business and to the people working in the business to have a degree of structured randomness to it, like, then they'd be much more likely to take advantage of opportunities that somebody in the company does, like random coffees. Before we went live, you were just talking about the idea of having emailing 100 people you wanted to talk to a year, and you said last year you got to talk to 62 of them. Well,
yeah.
I mean, I talk to 52 people, well, maybe with a couple of holidays, 50 people a year on these, and the vast majority of them are people I've never met before.
Exactly that. I have a list of 100 people
interesting people, you know?
All of that comes a big full circle there. So a friend of mine, Mary McKenna, came up with this idea of where she moved back to Ireland, she needed to be a bit more intentional about meeting people. So she wrote a list of people that sort of, you know, were in her network, but maybe had fallen off the radar a little bit. And that she wanted to catch up with before the year was out. And I've been doing that I've been doing it for about 4 years now. So we actually make a real effort to get in touch with people and go, I know, I'll follow you on Twitter. It'd be really great to catch up. Or, you know, I'm going to be in London. Let's go for a coffee. Actually being much more structured about it. And what I find with all of that is I'm yet to meet one I didn't like, and I normally will learn something new, and every now and then something will come out of it, you know, that we might have an opportunity to work together on something, or, you know, it's just someone that I could tap into for some advice now and again. But it's actually being much more intentional about building that network. Taking it back to what you were saying before about how do we create this opportunity? So there's an academic article I wang on about quite frequently by a guy called Eric M. Eisenberg. And he talks about actually, if you think about it as the model of, you know, a few guys who get together in a garage and jam as a band, that's actually a brilliant kind of collaboration, because at the beginning of that, you don't have a set idea in mind of what the music will sound like. You've just got an idea that, you know, you're going to get together and that you're going to make some music. So actually but there are some kind of preconditions there that you need to have. Basically, everyone needs to be able to have a basic level of competence of whatever instrument it is that they've picked up, and the ability to set some sort of rules, you know, what kind of meter or type of music are we playing? So actually there is a little bit there around, we need to create a structure for that serendipity, and we need to get the right kind of skills together to make it happen. But we need to be much less defined about what that looks like. And the challenge I think we have in the workplace is there is the sense that we only ever set people specific tasks with defined outcomes, when actually what we want to do, if we want serendipity, is to be much more comfortable with the idea that the outcome is undefined.
Yes.
That makes sense. So when we are thinking about that broader loop there, how do we help people to tap in? Is it that we need to create more opportunities for people with maybe complementary skills to get together on nothing in particular?
My answer is yes, because I've actually seen this with clients and others have deployed it. And at a philosophical level, I capture the idea that in order for it to be successful for the business, the highly counterintuitive requirement is that it must not have any defined outcomes. It must.
And that's hugely countercultural for
organizations. I was talking to an entrepreneur today who's built a very successful business and is great about vision and ideas, right? But actually doesn't really want to operate their business anymore. So those businesses, you tend to help them by putting in place some structures. When you go with mid to large corporates, typically the people who rise to the top of those organizations spent the first 20 years of their careers being, everything was about measurements and outcomes. And then I spend most of my time when I work with those people, get them to say, your job is not to have the answers, but to ask the right questions and to focus on vision and culture. That's it. That's your whole job. If you're measuring stuff, that's not your job anymore to go, but my whole career has been based on that. So it is very counterintuitive. In order to get results, you need to not be looking for results.
Exactly so. And that's really challenging for organizations to get their head around. And as you say, for the people within those organizations who don't come from that background, to be a bit more accepting of that kind of lack of structure.
I think my tip to them would be talk to me and I can put you onto other people, or talk to other people in your peer network and go, what have you done? What was your experience? And you'll find that those who've deployed this and actually and gone for it will find, wow, and here's story after story of how it generated actual tangible commercial results. I'm just going to summarize a couple of things. You know, you mentioned the broken connection between work and place, work and time. The Miss Marple piece, means motive opportunity. I love just, you know, thinking about the fact that it's the detective. That it's both and you know, when we see detective shows on TV, 80% of detective work at least is very boring desk work and desk research. Although some people love desk research. Just not me. But when you start like forensically looking at how are people using the tools you've got, who's using them, and then you talk about the interviews, which is the bit you do see Miss Marple do on TV. I love that bridge. And then really, you know, there's this ghastly concatenation of words of marcoms, marketing communications, but actually you put it together internally, and you know, any company which has internal systems, they're going to be communicating all the time. But yes, nobody goes to the internet to read the latest update, but they will go on there and see a widget that talks about, well, what's our latest, you know, story around people doing something serendipitously. And you can join the dots. So I've learned a hell of a lot listening, you know, having this conversation and listening to your thoughts on what you do. I like to give the guest the last word, and I guess maybe a request would be, what's one tip, you know, in amongst your last words, say whatever you like, but what's one tip you would give business leaders from what you've done, particularly the last couple of years?
Okay, over the last couple of years, the biggest thing for me, is it a tip or more of a general area to consider, is actually about the overall employee experience. So in a world where people are much less likely to be in a physical place, the role that digital tools and platforms play for employees is really in sharp focus. And reality is, go and take a look at that overall, end to end, because it's likely to be an absolute hot mess. Every single thing that makes it harder to find information is an irritant that actually makes people's working day less productive and starts to sort of chip away at engagement. So actually, for me, the biggest thing for the next couple of years is really about the digital employee experience and how breaking that connection between work and place and working time means that digital tools are really more critical than they've ever been. So how do we make sure that those are something that help people to get work done rather than hinder them?
Wow. And I am going to jump in on this rather than leave it last. So digital employee experience.
Absolutely.
And then I'm a first principles person. So what I'm fascinated by is if organizations will commit to research and assess their digital employee experience, that's going to give them some signals overall for the business beyond that, that go, what are our people doing to solve their problems?
Mm-hmm.
They might find that there's people are solving problems at all kinds of levels in their organization that they didn't even realize they needed to solve. So,
exactly so.
There will be absolute gold in that research. So that's just super fascinating. Anyway, I had, as always, I had no idea how this was going to go or where it was going to go.
Thank you so much for inviting me on.
It was beautifully serendipitous and random, and I've learned a lot, and I hope our podcast listeners do, and your tribe when you circulate this round to them.
Super. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolute pleasure, Sharon. Thank you, and have a good evening in Amsterdam.
You too. Cheers. Bye.
Bye.